San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from Kearny Mesa on this lovely Sunday night. Now it's time to introduce. Well, we have 50,000 watts of power, I should mention, and we're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's a marathon runner. He's a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego. And he is a family office expert advising many high net worth families. And his name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. I'm a little bit tired because I ran the Carlsbad Half Marathon this morning.
Wow.
And it's the first time I've competed since before my eye surgery.
Wow.
So the last couple, 3 miles weren't that easy.
Wow. How was the turnout?
There's about 8,500 runners in the half, and I think 3,000 or 4,000 in the full marathon.
Oh my gosh, and that's...
But the weather wasn't... It was really, like, well...
Was it wet?
It was windy. No, it had stopped raining, but it was windy.
Huh. Interesting.
So, well, but anyway, I made it alive.
Yeah.
So.
How was your time, by the way? Were you happy with it?
I was slower than last year. But, well, actually, you know, it was not bad. It just wasn't as good as last year, but I hadn't competed in, like, 3 months, so I didn't know what I was going to get. And so, gives me optimism.
Well, the other main question is how are your eyes coming along with that?
Oh, that's doing well. I'm going to pick up some new contact lenses next Friday, where I'll be 20/25 in the right eye. Last Thanksgiving, I couldn't see at all out of the right eye, so that's quite an improvement.
Yes. Well, the technology with the eye surgery these days must be miles ahead of what it used to be.
We
right?
We set a record with my eye surgery. First time in history that an eye longer than 30 millimeters, as far as anybody knows, had a lens replacement.
Huh. Interesting.
So I'm 34 millimeters. Average eye is only 18 millimeters in length.
We should bring your eye doctor on one of these nights, or some of your surgeons will do what David Letterman did.
It would be fun.
Why not?
Yeah, it would be fun. I guess my eye is going to be the subject of a medical journal article.
Wow. I'll have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, but, nice, Joe. Nice.
But I've got a good announcement to make as well. I know you've been giving me a lot of grief and aggravation about driving a gas guzzler for way too long. So I'm now the proud owner and father of a Prius.
Nice.
I bought it yesterday, and the really cool feature is this. There's a solar panel on top. And they've got a solar ventilation system. So if you park it in the direct sun, in 100-degree heat, it activates this ventilation system, and it cools the car off with an exhaust fan. And there's even a remote. You can activate the air conditioning remotely, which probably is no big deal for some other people who have the same thing. But, hey, I think that's pretty neat.
Well, it's about time. My mom loves her Prius.
Apparently a lot. I'm seeing so many of them on the road. Apparently a lot of people like their Prius.
Yeah, and I only objected to your old car, Joe, because you always had to take up three parking spots.
Hey, but it was safe. It was safe. So, hey, and hats off to Professor Frank.
His name would be Frank Partnoy.
Frank Partnoy, USD law professor, the esteemed law professor who's a frequent guest on 60 Minutes and an Oscar-winning documentaries, etc. And today he hosted a wonderful forum. And I wish you could have been there, Richard. I know you had other commitments, but all about the regulation of the markets. And he had Lynn, you probably know this fellow, Lynn Turner.
He's sure.
Former chief accountant for the U.S. SEC.
Yep.
And he had Darren Robbins from Robbins Geller there, and the judge Ronald Prager, and a defense attorney Koji Fukumura from Cooley. That law firm. But anyway, that was a fascinating program, and I wish you could have been there. So but kudos to USD for putting on these types of programs. I don't think any other academic institution in town is doing that. And across the way in another hall, only Justice Sotomayor was addressing another audience. So big day at USD today.
USD has great programs. Unfortunately, my alma mater's basketball team stinks.
Well, San Diego State's not doing so badly. So
no, but USD had, let's see, they had 34 points with 4 minutes to go in the game against Santa Clara. You know how hard that is to do, to get only 34 points in 36 minutes?
But they might all grow up to be good accountants like yourself.
Exactly. Richard, they'll grow up to host really nice events at USD, but they're not going to play in the NBA.
But anyway, that's all I had to say about that, and we'll see what happens in the Super Bowl. You have any favorite in the Super Bowl next week?
I'm picking the Niners, but I'm not a big football fan.
I'm not either. It's exciting sport to watch, but I tell you, you see more and more of these lawsuits for brain damage and whatnot. And I mean, what do you expect?
You see, the president spoke out against saying football might be too violent.
Huh?
You think? It's like it might be too violent.
I missed that. What did he say exactly?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if the federal government, the federal government gets involved in everything. Maybe they'll get involved in regulating football violence.
Well, I think
the challenge is with high school players and younger kids.
I think Congress should play football with no helmets, and that'll take care of that problem there. With we get a whole new crew in there. It's just a theory. Hey, Richard, we've got a wonderful show tonight, and I think we've taken up enough time, so how about we get into it?
Yeah, we're going to talk about La Valencia, but we've got to tell two stories about La Valencia before we introduce our guest. You have to go back to July to tell your first story, Joe.
Well, okay.
And then I'll tell the second one.
All right. Well, of course, July 8th was a historic day, one of many that happened at the La Valencia Hotel, but the Whaling Bar. A lot of people don't know, and I'm still going to say it, that Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel, lived in San Diego from, I think, 1946 till 1991, and wrote all but of about, I think, six of his books here in La Jolla in San Diego. And we had a plaque unveiled commemorating that fact in his favorite booth at the Whaling Bar, which is booth number 3, and we unveiled that on July 8th. And that evening at the Whaling Bar, we interviewed live on air the legendary sports commentator and broadcaster Dick Enberg. So that's that about that incident. And then you want to tell your story, Richard?
Oh, on Tuesday. Okay, so Tuesday I was at La Valencia having I had a 12:30 lunch in the dining room with my ghostwriter Summer. Because my next book hasn't come out yet, but it will in March. But the next book after the next book. I'm only writing one chapter called The Universal Wish. It's about how to make wishes come true, and the foreword's going to be by Frank Shankwitz, the founder of Make-A-Wish Foundation. It's also going to incorporate some of the stories from some of the Make-A-Wish kid. But I was meeting Summer to write my chapter for me because...
Wait, you're meeting Summer in the middle of winter.
Because my publisher made me write the book that I have coming out in March all by myself because it's sort of my story, so I needed a break. So I got the ghostwriter for just one chapter. For my contribution, and so we were going to meet at 12:30. Well, we did meet at 12:30 in the dining room at La Valencia to go over what it is I wanted to do for the book called The Universal Wish. And so I got there about 15 minutes early, so I called you, Joe, about 12:15 to talk about something on this radio show. And
you're calling me about Don Rickles saying...
I think it was about Don Rickles.
We're postponing the interview, we're booking it or whatever.
Yeah, I guess Don had the flu or something. Right. But anyway... So I'm talking to Joe. I'm sitting on the couch by the big window at the very end of the lobby, the window that overlooks the ocean at the end of the lobby in La Valencia, and the window's open, and I'm talking to Joe on my phone, and I hear this really loud seagull right outside the window, and I also hear the seagull in the background of Joe's cell phone. So I said, Joe, at this precise moment in time, you're standing on the balcony of La Valencia Hotel. And Joe said, how on earth could you possibly know that? Well, Joe was he was on the other side of the window, like 10 feet away from me, but I saw him and he didn't see me. Well, and you were so shocked.
I was having breakfast with my brother and his wife and my mother. We're all having a little breakfast out there. And you said, turn around.
Joe. I said, turn around.
I see his head in the window. I'm going to freak me. I thought this was like, I'm in the middle of a bad movie here or something. Anyway, funny.
Joe, introduce her. Anyway, I got to meet your lovely mother and brother, who's not as lovely as your mother, and his wife, who's lovelier than your brother.
And you also met Belle, the wonderful Chihuahua.
I met Belle, who was in the Chihuahua bag.
With the juicy logo, this
exactly.
Ugly-looking bag, but I don't know. It was a gift for my mother, but the dog likes the bag. What can I say?
That's good. Anyway, all of this has to do with La Valencia for a certain reason. Why is that, Joe?
Well, that is because tonight, there's a lot going on at the La Valencia. There's new ownership, and it's undergoing great changes and transitions. But one of the legends that is connected with the La Valencia Whaling Bar is the artwork. And the artist who did all that artwork is Wing Howard, and his son, Harrison Howard, is also an artist, and he is in studio tonight, and I'd like to welcome him to our microphone. So, Harrison, how are you this evening?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, of course, Luann is here with us as well, right?
That's right. My wife, Luann, is here just to make sure I don't say anything that I shouldn't.
Don't worry. We've got a six-second delay, so you can say whatever you want.
So, anyway, just to set this up, on the Whaling Bar on Valentine's Day, February 13th, that will be the last day it will be called the Whaling Bar, and it's going to undergo...
I think Valentine's Day might be February 14th.
Or 14th. What did I say?
13th.
I'm sorry.
14th.
Thanks. Good catch. Anyway, it's going to be closing for renovations or whatever, but they're going to preserve all the art and everything in there, and Wing Howard and his son Harrison... are going to actually create more art for the place. Is that the what's going to happen there, Harrison?
Well, I think that they're actually planning on moving the mural work that's there now around. So there are some additional panels that are in the hallways in the hotel, which were more or less replicated from the paintings that are in the dining room itself that were original to the La Rue Cafe and the Whaling Bar when they first opened. And I shouldn't say when they first opened, but from the time that they assumed those names. And that was in the late 40s.
Right.
And... Yep. Oh, go ahead.
You mentioned Cafe La Rue. Most people don't know about Cafe La Rue. They only think about the Whaling Bar. Right? At least most people I know go, Café La Rue.
And you have a good point, yes, and I think that's true, and this is probably a good time to make it clear what the Café La Rue is, because when the renovations that are about to take place are completed, the Café La Rue is really going to be the focal point of the that part of the hotel, and that's what will, in fact, replace the Whaling Bar. And the room as it now stands, and it has been since the 40s and probably before that, is divided in half. And the hotel decided that, and I think it's actually a very smart idea, they decided that by opening the whole room up and putting the bar in the center and opening doors out onto the existing patio, it's going to make the entire room more inviting, and it's going to breathe new life into the whole place. Mm-hmm. And I really think that that's actually going to happen.
More lively. I was there, I guess, Friday night with the golf tournament in town, and the lobby was packed and live music going on down by the piano. You know, I'm assuming that's for several years they've had many celebrities and stars coming through there and enjoying the facilities. Now, you as a youngster... where you worked as a valet there, you must have seen some notables come through there. Do you have any interesting things to say about?
I did, and I don't know if I can get in trouble for any of this, but
the statute of limitations has run. So
okay, thank you for clarifying that. I was just sort of trying quickly in my mind to figure out what I could get away with here. I do remember. What I remember is the most notable tip that I ever received, which was 25 cents. And I really had to work for that 25 cents. The person that gave it to me was Arthur Godfrey, who quite well known at, you know, years ago in television and radio and so forth. And he came to the hotel and he had a pink Cadillac. I think it was a Cadillac. It was a pink convertible car. And he'd come down from Los Angeles, and he had a whole entourage of people with him. And all of the other valets identified him. Everybody was fighting for who was going to be able to help him because they thought he was probably going to hand them a $20 bill. And somehow or other, I wound up with him. And he got out of the car with a great flourish. And I was asked to help not only with the bags, but also take some pictures of him in front of the hotel with his friends. So they handed the camera to me, and I just kept thinking to myself, boy, this is going to be some tip by the time I get done with all of this. We got all done with all of this, and he had a huge smile, and he said, here, this is for you. And he handed me a quarter.
Oh, my God.
And that...
And to this day, you remember that.
And to this day, I remember it. And he's no longer around, so hopefully none of his family members are listening to this. But
yeah, well, he thought he could take it with him, but he discovered otherwise, yeah. Right?
Well, we'll come back with some more tips right after this break. Stay tuned. We are back with It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and our special guest, artist Harrison Howard, and discussing him and Wing Howard. So, welcome back, gentlemen.
Joe, hey, Wing, let me ask you a question. So, can you describe to our listeners the murals that are in the Wailing Bar? Because a lot of people haven't been there. But what did your father paint for La Valencia, in other words?
He started his association with that hotel through a friendship with the manager in the 1940s. His name was Dick Irwin, and he managed the hotel for, I would say, up until about 1976 or 7. And he and my father worked out an arrangement so that my father could, at least for a while, stay in the hotel, or... He really wasn't staying in the hotel. I've seen this said before, but according to what my father told me, he had a studio in the hotel, and he used that room to paint, and the arrangement was that he would do some work for the hotel in exchange for the use of the room that he used as a studio. And originally, they had planned that he would, on a rotating basis, every now and then, he would just put another mural on top of the one that was in the bar. Huh. So, and actually, there was originally another mural underneath the whaling scene that was completely different, and it was a French park scene, and it had a number of women running around in various states of undress. They were in and these were Victorian ladies in their, I'm trying to think of corsets and so forth. Mm. So this wasn't anything that would raise too many eyebrows today, but they were being chased around the park by these lecherous French professors with butterfly nets. And
we've got to uncover that mural there. It might be a whole nother...
Well, it sat there for a few months, and then apparently the hotel and... decided that it wasn't quite the right thing to have over their bar. So they asked him to come up with something a little different, and that's when he got the idea of doing a whaling scene, mm-hmm. and which is what is now there, but although it has a rather circuitous history to it, because it was at one point covered up with another whaling scene that was eventually removed, mm-hmm. and the original painting was then restored. But the first when he did the whaling scene, they actually he played quite a part in laying out the booths, and he gathered my father was very interested in antiques, and he gathered a sort of a mini collection of scrimshaw and other bone artifacts and some harpoons and some small 19th century portraits. Naive American portraits, and all of these things were incorporated into the Whaling Bar at the same time, which some of which are still remain at this point. And when the changes occur, from what I'm told, the murals that are there, the main mural over the bar, and another one on the end wall will be removed, and they're going to make every effort to save them and remove them and put them in the boardroom of the hotel, probably.
Yeah. What was his inspiration to coming up with a whaling mural or whaling theme? Did he see the whaling industry on the East Coast?
Asked him that question, you know, and I never did. But he was very interested in history. He was interested in early Americana, and undoubtedly that all played a part in it. He had an older brother. That had an obsessive interest in marine antiques and mm-hmm. the history of those things, and you know that might have influenced him. I'm not really sure, but
your father's artistic career predated his work for La Valencia, correct?
It did, but not by he was very young when he did those murals. He was born in 1921, and he. He moved actually to California sometime in the early 40s during World War II. He had gone to a boarding school when he was a teenager in New Hampshire, and he had a skull fracture, and that put an end to any possibility that he ever might enter the military. And so he sat out the World War II, and during the time that he was in California, he was trained in hydraulics so that he could provide some sort of a retraining course to pilots in from the Pacific on landing gear systems as they updated the planes, I guess, that were being used. And I don't really know much about it, but I'm just saying this based on what he told me. But at any rate, other than doing that, he continued to paint, and he had that studio in the Valencia, and he did that mural, and they decided they really wanted to keep this whole theme of the whales, and that was that.
So he's about 25 years old, right? He's mid-20s.
He was actually even probably younger than that, maybe 23 when he did it, is what I think he told me.
Wow. But
I'm very mixed up about the chronology of his life from the time, say, 1941 to 1951, when my older brother was born. Mm-hmm. My parents, they never told me much about that 10-year period, and I've always sort of wondered what went on. So if there's anybody listening to this that can tell me something, I wish they'd give me a call.
Or get in touch with Harrison. He's got a website, harrisonhoward.com. You should, give contact information on there, I assume, right, Harrison, on your website?
I do.
Good, good, good.
But what year was the whaling bar, the iconic painting painted?
About 47, isn't
47?
It?
47?
I think it was 47.
Okay.
And I'd actually, until I started digging around before coming here tonight, I had thought it was maybe 1949, but I think it was, or now if it was 1947, that would have made him either 25 or 26. Mm-hmm. So not
interesting. And our guest last week has a whaling connection, which will Dr. Jacobs will talk about that after we come back from these announcements. Stay tuned. Back with It's Your Money and Your Life, and now over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
I'm going to thank some sponsors. I want to thank UBS, Mr. Michael Carantra and Drew Freitas. Very much appreciated. The best business banker in San Diego, Sean Puckett with Regions Bank. Jason Kruger, CPA with Signature Analytics. There is a new family member in the Kruger family. The baby was born a little bit early. I believe it was on January.
Quinn, right?
13th. Quinn, so
welcome aboard, Quinn.
Jason, I assume you're getting no sleep at night. That will only continue for about, at least 25 years. Joel Groshkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives. Joe, I know my kids are 21, 20, and 16. I haven't slept in 21 years. Anyway, Joel Groshkin, Cost Segregation Initiatives, our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic CPAs, dealing with the mess that the fiscal cliff resolution has caused. A lot of people can't file tax returns until early March because the IRS can't accept certain forms. Huh? Crazy. Rich Gaines, Family Legacy Legal, best estate planning attorney in town. And last but not least, Carl Scheeler with Business Valuations Limited. Thank you to everybody. And Joe, how can people find out more about our sponsors?
Well, if you go to our website, iymoney.com, and click on the sponsors button there, all their information about our sponsors, who are highly qualified professionals, you can get their phone information, their contact information, their history, their bios, etc. And also on our website, shout out to Courtney, who handles the website for us, right, Richard? She's terrific. On our homepage right now, there's a nice piece on Wing Howard and Harrison Howard, and she actually has some of the artwork. I don't know if you saw this, Harrison, yet, but it's scrolling through some of the different pieces, I guess, that are those yours or your dad's?
Well, the moving pictures are mine, and I much appreciate the inclusion in that post.
Yes, and you see the Whaling Bar mural up there as well. So
nice job by Courtney.
Yeah,
I think she wanted to put some exciting stuff up. That's why she put up Harrison stuff, because for me, she put up my latest YouTube video and I think a copy of my interview on ESPN Radio about a week ago. And I mean, who wants to listen to accounting, honestly?
When we left off, Dr. Irwin Jacobs, who was our guest last week, grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which was the whaling mecca of the U.S., I guess in the 1800s. And I don't know when they went, I guess by the time they were going over to oil in the 1900s, that all went away. But we had a very significant whaling industry in this country, as other places, right?
Nantucket was a big whaling spot. And I actually have an old friend that works in Boston. He's made documentaries for years, mainly through KPBS. Mm-hmm. He's worked on a lot of the major programs, and he did a documentary that they aired through KPBS about the black whaling community on Nantucket, and it was actually quite substantial, and it was a whole community unto itself. I mean, there was actually there was at least one black whaling captain that I know of, and it's a little known sort of piece of American history. I don't think a lot of people are aware.
So maybe your dad is now your grandfather, your dad's dad, was a noted anthropologist and an artist as well. He provided some of the inspiration, or probably a lot of the inspiration, for your dad, wouldn't you say?
Well, he was really a scientist, is the way I would characterize him, because he had graduate degrees in archaeology and I was going to say paleontology, but that's not correct.
Anthropology.
Yeah. And then he enjoyed drawing. I mean, he sketched, and my father held on to some of his sketchbooks that he kept as a soldier during World War I, and when he went on these field trips, mainly to New Mexico. He spent a lot of time in New Mexico looking for the remains of early Native Americans, and also at the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. This was in the 30s, and my father got very interested. I think my father was a very curious mind, and I think part of that was the result of his father's intellectual curiosity and going and seeing his father conducting these excavations.
And he saw a lot of different parts of the world growing up, right? So this probably gave his fertile mind the grist for his artistic mill, wouldn't you say?
That's a pretty good description. His family traveled a lot when he was growing up. They made quite a few trips to Europe, and I think his mother and father were rather different personalities in a lot of ways. His mother would rather have spent the summer in a hotel in Europe, and his father would rather have spent the summer in a dust heap camped out in
digging
southern
somewhere.
New Mexico.
Well, he's probably saw life from both ends of the spectrum then, right?
I think that probably both of those things affected him. I know he liked a lot of the comforts in life, but I also think he was very curious about many things. He was very interested in history and art, and he and my mother had a life that I think revolved heavily around their interest in those things and antiques, and they traveled a lot, and I think all of that was probably partly influenced by his own experience growing up.
And how would you describe your father's artistic style as a painter, and did it change over time?
It did change a good deal, and he actually wrote a children's book when he was a children's picture book when he was 16, and it was about a frog called Francois, and Francois's father was caught and eaten by a pompous French chef, and Francois set off for Hollywood, where he actually got very successful, and he started to enjoy a lot of the finer things in life. He liked fancy restaurants and expensive clothes and cars, and somehow Francois had a fall from grace, And in the end of the story, though, he redeemed himself. But it, and my father's illustrations of this were very clever. They were, and they were amazing for somebody that had no artistic, real artistic training. And it wasn't, it was never published, but it was a very imaginative story. And you could see, I could see in that the beginning of somebody who's going to wind up being an artist. And later, after he had a concussion in boarding school, he was bedridden for about 2 months, and he was told that he couldn't read. So he had to, he went home. He laid in bed and he stared at the wall, and there was some wallpaper that didn't particularly appeal to him. And he started thinking to himself, you know, somebody could have made designed this a little better. And after he got well enough to do anything, he started making paintings on wallpaper. Wow. And this turned into a whole thing for him. And he, by the time he was 20, he had an exhibit at the Philadelphia Print Club. He was very young to do this. Mm-hmm. And they put this thing on. He was he got very positive reviews, and he sold quite a bit of stuff. He had watercolors, and he had these wallpaper designs that he made. He picked out scenic subjects and things from his travels with his family.
He was seeing Paris, New Orleans, rural Pennsylvania, and Maine. That were the main subjects of that show.
Exactly. And he I think he did some circus subjects and some things that were aimed at children. Mm-hmm. And he was very, he did these things very quickly. And and his style, to go back to what you asked, at that point in time, I mean, he was really a self-taught artist. But he had something very unique about what he did that you that I can see in his earliest, from his earliest work. And it sold well. And he, after the show with the print club, he had another one about a year later. And then he wound, during the, after the war started, he did come to California. And sometime along in that period, he started to have exhibits through some galleries in New York. First one called Farragill, and then another one after that where he had several shows that he did very well with called Nerdlers. And Nerdlers actually very sadly closed this last year. I mean, they were caught in the midst of a really major public scandal, which was pretty incredible to me to read about, because Nerdlers at one point had been owned by the industrialist Arm & Hammer. Mm. And he brought this huge show, which I remember going to see in New York in the 70s, in the mid-70s, from the Pushkin Gallery in Russia, I mean, which was a pretty amazing thing to do during the height of the Cold War. It was a, you know, it was sort of a landmark thing where he brought all these major impressionist paintings and stuff.
He was well connected with the Russian hierarchy, wasn't he? I might recall.
So it was just an interesting sort of, you know, it was an interesting place for my father to be involved. And I'm sorry, in looking back at it all, he backed away from the art galleries in the mid-60s. And I think part of the reason he did that was, a large part of it was, he just didn't like paying the commissions. Mm. But I think it was probably a bad career choice, because while he made more, earned more money in the short run, I think that the media attention that exposure he had been getting backed way down as a result of that.
But he had some very notable clients. I'm looking at the biographical material. You know, Charles Boyer, Fanny Brice, Pierre DuPont, the Honorable Douglas Dillon. Look at this: Henry Fonda, Jane Fonda, all these names: Goodyear, Firestone, Ford, Henry Luce, Fred McMurray. A Rockefeller is honored, Vincent Price.
He gave art lessons to Fred McMurray.
Is that right? I'll bet he gave him a quarter, too. I heard he was pretty tight with a buck. let's hold that thought. We'll come right back with more of his
story. I always pictured him as being very... the only thing I know about Fred McMurray is from watching My Three Sons, I imagined somebody that was very...
Yeah, but we got to take a break now, right, Harrison? We'll come right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life and talk more about Fred McMurray. All right. And we're back with that great bonanza music with the last segment of It's Your Money on Your Life with Richard Musio, myself, and our special guest, Harrison Howard, son of Wing Howard, both great artists in their own right. And we're in the home stretch here, Harrison. So we left off with Fred McMurray. I wanted to know where else could we see your art or your dad's art in California or any other places in and around the country, mural-wise, and then also we talked about the idea of maybe having a joint show at some point in time, which you said did happen back in 73, right?
It did, and it was the first exhibit that I was involved in, and it was arranged really through my father at the who had had an exhibit already at Ross Thiel and Son in La Jolla,
mm-hmm.
and I've had a long association with Ross Thiel and Son and with that family, and my wife Lou Ann has actually had a friendship with the now owner of Ross Thiel and Son since she was a second grader.
Wow.
So there was all this these interconnections between the Howard family and the Thiel family, mm-hmm. and that certainly played a part in my experience living in La Jolla. But as far as seeing my father's work elsewhere, I feel like I really should do something about this. What happened was, as he stopped exhibiting through galleries, his work gradually vanished into private hands, and the family, the people that bought these, the paintings have tended to be passed down from parents to children and grandchildren, and I just feel, from the standpoint of preserving his legacy, I probably should make some effort. I would like to
track down a Vanderbilt or a Rockefeller.
Well, I know where a lot of these paintings are, because he kept a reasonably good record albums with photos of each, just snapshots, not very good pictures, unfortunately, but he recorded on the back of each picture over the years who he sold it to and where and for how much and so forth. So, I mean, if I really wanted to do some detective work, I could probably round up enough to, to put this into a cohesive record.
You know, we got to approach the San Diego Museum of Art, and maybe we can have a special exhibit. Who knows?
There's a couple pieces of your dad's work at La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club, right?
There are a couple of watercolors that found their way there. I don't think the Beach and Tennis Club originally bought them from him. I think he sold them to somebody else, and then I think they were, one of them at least, may have been in a bank, and then somehow they wound up in the hands of the Beach and Tennis Club. I don't even know the story behind it, but one of them is in fact of the Beach and Tennis Club, and that's obviously why they wanted to have it. He did a number of paintings there in the 70s. He and my mother were members, and he would make sketches down there and turn them into paintings of that time. They had the cabanas and the umbrellas. They still have the umbrellas, but they had the cabanas, which they took away, and they were very colorful, and that it just appealed to him as a subject.
Now, your dad had this great sense of humor and this great personality. Didn't that help enhance his business success?
Oh, it did. He was just a naturally at ease person. He spoke very easily to other people, and he really had a terrific sense of humor. And he was, I would also say, he was just a sort of a natural born salesman. And I don't think of that associated with very many artists. That didn't get passed on to me.
Well, you need to be a good, there's a good documentary, I'd recommend it to anybody who's interested in art, and it's called The Art of the Steel. It's about Dr. Alvin Barnes and the whole development of his art gallery. He bought a lot of this impressionist work.
I know the Barnes Foundation.
Yeah, it became worth $25 billion over time, but this guy was a master promoter, very interesting character. So that's the life lesson. Richard, you've met some artists. I mean, some of them are, they're not happy campers. They're troubled people or whatever. You hear the tortured genius and all that. I don't, I don't think you're going to sell too many pieces if they can't get along with people.
I've always thought of a lot of artists as being loners. I've thought of a lot of artists as being loners.
Yeah, yeah. So, I just think, personality and people skills can always help.
They're very important. And I'd like to say that I hope we're not describing me. I don't think of myself as either tortured or a loner. Actually, I like people. But I just wanted to make them note of that while I have the opportunity. And
he smiles a lot, Luann. I think he's a nice guy. I think you scored pretty well here, my dear. So,
I think you're touching on a subject, a very sensitive point here. But I must say that over the years, I've thought to myself that
we have to wrap it. What'd you think, real quick? What'd you think?
This was great. Okay. I really appreciate having the chance to be here.
Yeah, we thank you,
thank
Harrison.
You.
Luann, good to see you. Richard, good to see you.
Everybody, have a great week.
Yeah, have a great week. Thanks to Justin Hart on our board, our board operator, and thanks to Craig Blank, your account executive. And thank you to Dave Sniff, who is our programming genius. Yeah, everybody, have a great week. Stay warm. The weather's going to get better, I predict. So stay tuned and for next week. And who do we have next week? Do we know yet, Richard?
I'll know on Monday. It's tomorrow.
Okay. All right, so get on the blog, iymoney.com, and have a great week. Good night.
Follow Sean Hannity tomorrow noon to 3. Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
ATS lease offer is subject to approved credit. To it this payment. Numbers 139980 and 140440. Offer expires 131-2013. All units subject to prior sale.
Do something great for yourself this year. You deserve it. Lease the all-new 2013 ATS sports sedan for only $339 per month plus tax for 36 months, and you pay nothing at signing. This is the New Year special for Slater Crusaders only, a super low sign-and-drive lease on the amazing new ATS. Keep your cash in the bank and drive this amazing car. Your first payment is paid for, as well as all fees and no security deposit. You're going to love your buying experience at North County Buick Cadillac GMC. I did. Again, lease the all-new Cadillac ATS. Monthly payments of only $339 plus tax, and you get a generous 12,000 mile per year and only 25 cents per mile if you go over. North County Buick Cadillac GMC in the Escondido Auto Park. Check them out, ncbcg.com.
We follow the story.